The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's presentation is from CEO of Indiana University Health, Dan Evans.
What direction is healthcare taking in the world today? We see changes in healthcare. Healthcare is paid for through the Affordable Care Act. We see changes in the way healthcare is charged as some providers move from a fee-for-service model to a value-based model, and in the growth of concierge healthcare. Our speaker today can provide us with some well-founded insight. Dan Evans is the president and CEO of IU Health, the state's largest healthcare system, and represents the fourth generation of a family that has led a major healthcare institution in Indiana going all the way back to 1899. Dan evolved into that role after several years of leadership at Methodist Hospital, where his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather served on the board of directors. Dan graduated from IU School of Law and served until 1989 as the chairman of the Indiana Board of Corrections. He practiced law for over 17 years for Baker and Daniels. Dan is widely sought after to join many corporate and civic boards, apart from the major leadership roles in healthcare industry. Among such organizations are the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership, the IUPUI Board of Advisors, the University of Indianapolis, the Citizens Energy Group, the Indiana Legal Foundation, and the Greater Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce. Good Lord, man, when do you work? That's incredible. Please join me in welcoming one of Indiana's most respected leaders who is well qualified to speak on many subjects, especially American healthcare, Dan Evans.
Good afternoon. I got to tell you, thank you. This is very intimidating. Let me tell you why. I do give speeches from time to time, and in fact, often, and I do give them around the country to different groups, but this is different. And what's different is I look out over the room and I see my friends and neighbors. I see my colleagues. I see family. I see people I've known my entire life in the room. If my mother were still alive, I would know by 3 o'clock this afternoon how well I'd done. No joke. Dad was with Ayers, as some of you may know, and if I ate in the tea room, I'd always order a hot fudge sundae and a chicken pot pie with peas, and I'd eat everything except the peas. And Mom would usually know about 3:30 from one of the waitresses how I'd done. So I feel the sense of community in this room, and out of a sense of community comes a sense of responsibility. So I hope that the next 15 or 20 minutes is worth your time, because it's certainly worth my time. The pace of change in healthcare, I don't need to tell you about, do I? I really don't. Not only is the cheese being moved, it's being hidden. That everybody is being subjected to change at a rate that is sometimes alarming to folks. So I decided I would refresh my memory on what's happened just in the past 6 years to add a fine edge to it. In July of 2009, Nancy Pelosi announced the Affordable Care Act, and it was introduced. In November of that year, the House voted, 4 months later, 219-1 to pass the Affordable Care Act. The Senate voted shortly thereafter, and no Republicans voted for it. One in the House voted for it. Then remember what happened? Teddy Kennedy died. And when Teddy Kennedy died, the Democrat 60-vote supermajority in the Senate was at risk. The governor of Massachusetts appointed a Democrat. A special election was called, and the Democrat lost to Scott Brown, a Republican. So the Democrats didn't have their 60-vote supermajority. So they had to do it through a non-supermajority methodology, a budget reconciliation, which is too moogie-foogie to discuss now, and even I don't understand it, even though I've had it explained to me 51,000 times. So the bill passed on March 11th, 2010. Scott Brown is in the Senate at that time. 51 votes. 8 Democrats voted against it. On 3/23/10, Obama signed it. On 6/28/12, the Supreme Court issued its first ruling on it. And on March 3rd, 2 weeks from now, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments on certain parts of the Act's constitutionality. That's a lot of change. And the problem with this particular change, it's created lots of uncertainty. So we at IU Health and the other health systems in town, to which at this moment I'd like to give a shout out, many of my colleagues are in the room from the other systems in town. We work often together, in fact, most of the time, wouldn't you say, together. And I know that if a member of my family has a health care need and it arises in a situation in which they use services at what some industries might call a competitor, I want that competitor to be just as good as we are, if not better, on that given day, right? So the market attitude, even though it may appear fiercely competitive, at the end of the day, it's about providing high-quality care to everybody in the community. So today, my theme, though, is not going to be what you think. You ready? Today, I'm going to make a few comments that will render me totally unqualified to ever run for, much less hold, public office. So if there's any petition campaign going on in the room, you can take the paper, just put it away right now. I feel like Governor Brannigan in, 68 who said, if nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve. But I am going to disqualify myself by what I'm about to say. I'm going to talk about America's need for a new social contract. And I'll define that in a few minutes for you. My thesis is we need a new social contract with regard to health care and our commitments to ourselves and various groups in our society. What do I mean by the contract? I mean an implicit agreement among the members of an organized society or between the governed and the government, defining and limiting the rights and duties of each. Now, I know that sounds like a civic class, but that means you give me something as a member of society, and I have an obligation back to you, society. It's a deal. It's a contract. And with health care, the deals become whopper-jawed, a legal term. That is, I get to take as much as I need, and I don't have to give much, if anything, back. And I'll go into that in a little bit of detail. The idea of a social contract, as the academics in the room know, is hardly a new idea. In fact, it's sort of a hallmark of modern society. Rousseau, right? Winthrop, City on a Hill. We've been talking about what our relationship should be for hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of years. The founders of our country and the framers of the Constitution had some of these ideas in mind as they were drafting. And I'm no historian, so if I conflate anything, I hope that you'll forgive it, because I haven't, and there, as I said, there are plenty of fact checkers in the room. But I think I am right on the issue of the idea of a society's rights and responsibilities to itself have been around for some time in our society. Americans spent about $3 trillion on health care in 2014. That's about 18% of the GDP. Since the 1960s, the rate of health care growth has been 2 times the rate of inflation of GDP growth. In the last couple of years, Cherie, the truth is it's actually slowed a little bit in the last couple of years. Now, you tell me, is that high deductibles? Is that larger co-pays? Is that more people entering the uninsured? These are the studies that are yet to be done. And is the inference to be drawn from that if people are deferring care so that at some point in future the actual health status of the communities that we live in will decline? I'll talk about that in a little bit as well. The number of uninsured has declined by more than 8% since the ACA was implemented. Many people now have deductibles of about $5,000. Here's a fact. You can check it on your iPhones right now. I think the average American's liquidity is about $500, right, Nick? It's something like that. In other words, a $5,000 bill to the average American might as well be a $5 million bill. So a $5,000 deductible to the average household, which you are not it, by the way, to the average household is different than a $5,000 bill to one of our households. Indiana has the second highest percentage of insured through high deductible plans in the United States. High deductible plans are one reason why hospitals across the country and Indiana are seeing declines in patient volumes. I can't speak for my colleagues around the country, but all I know is the national, state, and local data, not hospital-specific, and I can tell you that inpatient volumes are down mostly every place in the country. Now, in a perverse way, you might say, well, Dan, that means you're selling less inventory, right? Well, no, our mission now is to keep people out of the hospital, right? I'll talk about that more in just a second as well. Medicare provides pretty good care for those over 65. Medicare currently covers more than 50 million Americans and costs more than $500 billion. Now, it depends on who you talk to, how many thousands of people per day are becoming eligible for Medicare. In my Wikipedia research, which is my sole source these days, it's either 7,000 a day or 11,000 a day. In other words, it's a big number. And who is it? It is the baby boomers born after 1946. I was born in 1949, and I have a feeling there are a number of people plus or minus 10 years from that date in the room who are entering into the class of individuals who will use Medicare. In 1970, Medicare was 3% of the federal budget. In 2013, it's 14% of the budget. When you turn 65 in 1965, you're expected to live to 78. If you turn 65 today, you're expected to live to be 83. And that number is only going one way. It's going up. So the burden on the Medicare trust fund is large. In Indiana, Medicaid enrollment increased by more than 40% between 2003 and 2013, and the state's costs have gone by more than 50%. Now, I was on the Methodist. You heard about my pedigree at Methodist, so you think I know everything. But the truth of the matter is I was on the board for years before I knew the difference in Medicare and Medicaid. You don't have to raise your hands. But truthfully, really, why would you know? Medicare is for older folks. Medicaid is for poor folks. A dual eligible is an old poor person, but basically you can divide it in those two categories. It used to be a small part of hospital reimbursement. Now it's, in most cases, the majority of the reimbursement. I'd like to give a shout out to Governor Pence and HIP 2.0, and I'll put that in more context later on. Remember the votes I told you about just a few minutes ago? He was the whip on the Republican side. He was a leader marshaling the votes against the Affordable Care Act. He's become a leader in the country in taking the good parts of the Affordable Care Act and his great creativity in creating HIP 2.0, which I think the rights and the responsibilities that it confers on people less fortunate to us is a new form of social contract. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. Social contract theory was a key focus of 18th century political philosophers I've mentioned, like Hume, Rousseau, and Locke, who developed theories about man's natural rights and liberties and the origins of government. It was heavily influenced the founders as they made a case for independence from Britain and designed the Constitution. Essentially, the point of the social contract, is that we as individuals agree to give up certain liberties and commit to follow the rules of society in order to gain the many benefits of life. For it to work, it has to be fair and essentially voluntary. You can't be forced into a social deal if it's not voluntary, at least, and be expected to be 100% compliant with it. I hope I haven't lost you by now, but I wanted you to keep in mind that the idea of a social contract is rights and responsibilities. We also agree to a set of mutual responsibilities. For example, that the fortunate will provide assistance to the less fortunate, who in turn have a responsibility to use that assistance to try to regain their independence or their health. The American model of social contract differs a lot from that of Europe. Europe does not have the tradition of self-help. So what is our social contract today, and who are the beneficiaries of it? Until the 20th century, Americans mostly depended on themselves, their families, neighbors, and communities to provide help and support in times of need. The Great Depression changed all that, And you don't have to be a student of history to know that the Social Security Act was 1933. I think I read you the stats a minute ago. It's the Medicare stats times 10. That is, you were expected to die, I think, 8 or 9 years before you qualified for Social Security. I read yesterday in preparing these remarks that if that rate of, let's say, life expectancy inflation were applied, you wouldn't qualify for Social Security benefits till you're 80. Now, some of you may recall Gary Becker, the University of Chicago economist. He was here 4 years ago. He sat right there. I sat next to him. I was impressed by two things. One, the notes for his speech were written on a Marriott placemat. I think this wasn't his first rodeo. And two, he stood up at this lectern and said, I'm 80 years old. You all are paying me to be here, and I'm getting Social Security benefits. What's wrong with that picture? And you may recall, he's the one who invented the spoiled child theory, sort of like the prodigal son, except in economic terms. So he was just a stitch to listen to. I'm almost sorry I brought him up, because now you're all going to compare me to him. There were less than 9 million Americans over the age of 65 in the 1930s. So today there are more than 40 million senior citizens in America. I count myself among them, regrettably. You know, when you go into the Wendy's and the young woman on the other side doesn't ask you if you qualify for the discount, you're there. You're there. And when I saw that it was actually fairly substantial, I didn't object anymore. I'd become my father, you know. Dad would say, well, where's to the woman, and Nora behind the woods, where's my discount? And she said, sorry, sir, here's your, now I'm there. The Affordable Care Act extends health care entitlement to working age Americans as well as children and elderly. The Affordable Care Act brings us close to universal coverage as we're going to get, I think, in the near future, maybe in our lifetimes. But the Affordable Care Act added about $1 trillion of new money to be spent in a new entitlement program. And so it kind of calls the question, doesn't it? We can't afford the commitments we've made to ourselves. We cannot afford the commitments we've made to ourselves. Unfunded liabilities of the Social Security program are $12 trillion. Unfunded liabilities of the Medicare program exceed $30 trillion. Costs of the ACA could exceed $6 trillion over its first several years. The U.S. GDP, just for purposes of comparison, is $17 trillion. So do the math. You can use your own income as a guide. Could you survive if your income was X and all of your liabilities were the same ratio as these? So what are we all confronting? I think we're all confronting the realities of actuarial science. Whoever used the word actuarial until the Affordable Care Act passed? You know, I had an uncle who was an actuary, and that's as close as I ever got to using the word actuarial science. And now all of a sudden we're all presumed to be experts in actuarial science. That is the management of risk, right? And that's what actuarial science is all about. But we have a two-pronged issue going on here. I'd ask you Hoosiers to pay special attention to this because it particularly affects us. We've got actuarial science, namely the aging of the population. That's inexorable. That is happening. And we've got innovation. So we're making it possible for people to live even longer. So one of IU Health's hallmarks is our partnership with the IU School of Medicine. Dean Hess and some of his colleagues are here. Jim Morris, a trustee of the university. We are very proud of that partnership. It's important to our identity, and you should be too, because that's a place that not only trains physicians to work here in Indiana, but is a hotbed of innovation. And within 100 miles of this spot, over a third of all the implants in the world are manufactured, Warsaw, Indiana. So if your mom needs a hip, it's manufactured just up the street. So if we started, if we stop putting hips in people at a certain age, what part of the economy would be hit first? It would be us. So, little story. My mom's family's from Frankfurt. And here's my memory of my grandmother, Sloan, as a little boy. She lived in the dining room. And the kitchen, between the dining room and the kitchen, and my grandfather converted a closet to a bathroom because she had a bad hip. She couldn't go up and down the stairs. My mother and my aunt, her daughters, between them had 3 hip replacements. So I'm presuming my grandmother, actuarially, cost society nothing. Cared for in the home. All retrofitting was done in the home, and she died at home. My mom, And my aunt, I don't know what they cost, but I'll bet it's low six figures. So tell me, what's that social contract, and is it a good or a bad thing? No one would argue that an able-bodied person who has a disability that medical innovation is able to cure and put them back in society, particularly in the workforce, taking care of their families if they're not in the workforce, isn't a good thing. In fact, that's a very good thing. And so my mother was mobile to the very, in fact, she had a hip replacement for so long the hip replacement broke. She wore out the hip replacement, and my aunt, who's still alive, would be immobile if it weren't for that. So innovation is a wonderful thing, and it's the source of a whole other speech, and you should invite the dean to give the speech. But this country is ambivalent about innovation today. We are investing less in it rather than more today. That's a fact. So the time is ripe for discussion of a new social contract. With some humility, because this is what's going to disqualify me from ever holding office, I have a few views on what key elements of such a contract would be. My first contention is that we must focus the resources we allocate as a society for mutual aid on those who really need it, which would disqualify a lot of people in this room, depending upon how you did the calculation. There's no reason anymore for entitlement based solely on age. Those of us over 65 are the wealthiest segment of the American population. Many of us don't need and shouldn't receive financial assistance from government when resources are finite and limited. Here's some numbers from the latest CBO budget document. CBO estimates government spending will increase $2.6 trillion between 2014 and 2025. 90% of that increase will come from Social Security, health spending, and interest on the federal debt. It's just simply unsustainable. From 2016 to 2025, population-adjusted spending will increase 27% for Social Security and 24% for Medicare, while spending drops 19% for defense and other government programs. So let me, in case you're not getting me on this one, let me put a finer point on it for you. That means I want you to consider if you want end-of-life care, which is very expensive for your mom and for my mom, been there, done that, haven't you? If you want that money spent on children, if you invested that same amount of money on an eight-month-old, you get 80 years of productive life if you were successful. If you invest resources on an 80-year-old on your best day, you're not going to get that same return. Now I'm sounding like an actuary, aren't I? So this is why this goes no place in America, and I'll finish up with a couple of comments on that. This is your decision, not Uncle Sam's decision. Remember, President Obama mentioned during the run-up to the ACA that part of it would provide primary care docs reimbursement for Medicare patients for a once-a-year discussion on end-of-life care. And suddenly that became President Obama is in favor of death panels. So, boy, he dropped that baby. It was gone. But it was an appropriate conversation, and he should be commended and supported for bringing it up, not criticized. As the CEO of a health system that cares for people from cradle to grave, I see this up front and personal as an inappropriate social investment firsthand. The return on investment, if you will, for the way we invest money in healthcare delivery is right now whopper-jawed on the senior side and under-invested on the younger side. So my first contention is mutual aid should only go to those folks who need it. My second tenet of a new social contract is, you're not going to like this one either, so is there a shield down here? First time I went to a speech with President H.W. Bush, I realized that only he had a metal shield in front of his podium and the rest of us were on our own. And then I went to Nicaragua with Vice President Quayle when Violeta Chamorro was sworn in and Ortega was thrown out with Senator Lugar. And Senator Lugar's to my right, and the Secret Service turned to us just as soon as we walked into a baseball stadium where Violeta Chamorro was being sworn in and said, if there's any trouble, you people are on your own. We figured, Senator Lugar and I figured, we were the only people in that baseball stadium that didn't have an automatic rifle with them. Everybody else was heavily armed, and I said to my wife when I got home, I said, I think that was a mistake to go. The second tenet is our obligation to take care of ourselves. Part of our mutual obligation to teach to each other is to not take the resources from society irresponsibly, to take care of ourselves as best we can. 5% of our patients, for one reason or another, account for 60% of our costs. And you can take that number and run it through, those of you who are businesses, you can run it through your human resources departments, and you'll see a similar skew of a few using a lot, and they tend to be chronic diseases and things of that sort. IU Health is, among other things, shares its identity with the Methodist Church, and John Wesley espoused the responsibility of the idea of responsible grace. It's the same thing. It's saying, I can give you grace, but you must use it responsibly, or I can't share it with enough other people who may need it more than you. Chronic conditions are exploding and a key cause of the rapid increase in healthcare rates. So, at the end of life, what do you think becomes most important? Your lifespan or your health span? I just made that up. Your lifespan or your health span? How long are you going to actually stay healthy? Are you making the right choices yourselves? I know I've only got 3 minutes left here, so I'm going to make this quick. I was in Cuba a year ago in a tiny clinic in the middle of nowhere. And Cuba's touted for its health care, and it was kind of impressive how they were organized. They had no facilities, however. I mean, the facilities were awful. I went into an outpatient clinic that had a bunch of obese, smoking patients. And right behind them on the wall was a sign in Spanish that said, your care today is free, but it costs. Then it had a list of what it actually costs. You know, so many pesos for this, so many pesos. So I said to the doctor who was there, I said, why this? She said, oh, our people don't take care of themselves and they overutilize our resources. I said, amigo, America. You know, so this is the human condition. We just happen to be on the edge of our noncompliance here in North America. So, the final contract, the final element of the new contract involves my obligations and my colleagues' obligations as the CEO of a large system. We need to transform from the focus on health care, that is providing care, to health. In other words, our institutions shouldn't be sickness institutions. They should be institutions that assist you in staying out of them. So we need to be responsible for the health of the communities we serve, not for responding to acute care needs solely. Regrettably, the way society pays us is for the latter, not the former. So we get paid for the acute care episodes, and we don't get paid for, if we do, it's not very much. We don't get paid for keeping you out of the hospital. For instance, we're not reimbursed for smoking cessation, dietary coaching, wellness programs. We're really not reimbursed except for a few areas on quality service scores or efficiency of care provided. I encourage you to think about this concept of social contract. We're not going to win the actuarial fight without changing behavior. So what do I want you to do today? Here's your homework today. When you get home tonight, I'm serious, have a conversation with your significant other. If you don't have one, then have it with your mom, dad, sister, brother, next door neighbor, and talk about the social contract. Don't use that word, but see if they're prepared and see if you're prepared for the new world that lies ahead and for managing your own care.
We have time for a few questions. So as a reminder, you have white cards on your table. Please write legibly and hold those up, and staff will be around to collect them, or tweet us at Economic Club IN. I'll get us started. Are there any specific features in Obamacare, we talked about a little bit, you did, as adopted, that are worth retaining in the new act?
I've been asked that question, I cannot tell you how many times, by Democrats and Republicans, by members of Congress who actually have a vote on the matter. And you know, there are many good things in Obamacare. I would say number one on my list would be pre-existing conditions. You can't be excluded for pre-existing. A close second would be your kid can stay on your policy till you're 26. How many parents have lived through that? The third would be a subsidy for people that are truly poor. The fourth would be some of the wellness programs on it. Most of the Obamacare flaws are actuarial. You know, we want. So what happened 2 days ago? We hit the deadline for signing up this year. And what happened? People didn't sign up. And so what happened? The Democrats in Congress want to waive the rules. They don't view that as political, but it's true. The Democrats wanted to waive the rules. So I guess there aren't any rules, right? So they don't believe in a social contract. But on the other hand, it means we have to help enroll people. And there are many folks in this room, especially the hospital systems, that have hired navigators and others to assist people in enrolling.
Sorry.
You told me you're going to screen those questions.
This one caught me. So why does IU Health merit nonprofit status?
Well, there's an easy one.
I only got two, and one I can't.
Who asked that?
That's all.
Raise your hand. Who asked that? Who asked that question? I can give you the history of nonprofit law. Would you like to hear? This is a bar exam question. The law says that in order for a hospital to maintain its exempt status, it must perform an exempt purpose. And those include education, research, and clinical care. In most community hospitals, the legal basis for an exemption from taxes is the charity care. Now, this is I made fun of the question, but this is actually a very sophisticated question. Because if the Affordable Care Act is fully implemented, and HIP 2.0 says what it says to do, it's possible, if not likely, that the amount of charity care that the hospital systems do will decline dramatically. So I think it's only a matter of time until Senator Grassley, who's the scourge of 501c3s, in other words, he demands accountability, will be asking that question. Okay, guys, you're making a 5, 10, 15% return and you have no basic material charity care anymore. Why do you have exempt status? Or worse yet, who will be asking is you, the local communities, because we don't pay property taxes either. So these institutions, the big 501c3 hospitals, are like government entities. They don't pay taxes to any. Now we pay payroll taxes and all that kind of stuff, and we own a bunch of for-profit companies, but our core business is tax exempt. I'd be happy to talk to that person outside the room on Georgia Street. I'm going out the I'll be going out the Maryland Street entrance. Wait for me. I'll be there eventually.
You must know this crowd quite well because I have a whole stack of questions. So I've gotten two, but I'm going to go ahead and ask one more of you before we run out of time. We seem to spend a larger share of our national wealth on health care in America compared to other nations. And do you think we're getting our sufficient bang for our buck as a result?
I don't want to fly off into the stratosphere here, but American health care is not like other health care. We do provide more. So if you visit somebody in Europe, the amount of post-acute care provided in Europe is de minima compared to the amount of post-acute care, nursing home care, that's provided here. So there's one big difference. We provide care to a higher acuity, meaning sicker people get care here, meaning at certain ages in certain other societies, you simply don't get the things that would be done here because they have applied a return on investment scale. So if you're at a certain age, don't quote me, this is just between us. If you're in Britain and you're over a certain age and you've got a bad hip like my mom, the orthopedic device that you get is a cane. And a cane is a lot less expensive than an implant. So the it's not a joke, but the fact is healthcare costs more here because it costs more. That's not to say that it's not inefficient. And obviously society believes that it is inefficient because the Affordable Care Act itself contains dramatic cuts to reimbursement. So the deal in the Affordable Care Act was Medicare would be cut. That happened 3 years ago. And Medicaid would be expanded. So I don't know how many states it is, 29, 34, have not expanded Medicaid. Indiana just did it. So you see the symmetry of it is not there quite yet. So we're seeking a balance between the two.
Excellent. One last question. Do you believe that any legislation can promote the development of a new social contract?
I was thinking about this. Have I gone over into the deep end here talking about the social contract? Because the whole idea of a social contract is what society agrees to do to itself. So the core of it is voluntary. But once you've done the voluntary part, then an obligation arises. And if you don't want to be part of that society, you move to Canada, right? Or you move to Mexico. If you don't want to be part of this society, you just move on. Now, that doesn't happen very often because our social contract's actually pretty good. The Affordable Care Act and HIP 2.0 are statutes that encourage a social contract that if they were followed to their letter and they actually caused people to become more compliant because they've got higher deductibles or co-pays or stuff like that, then the burden on the system would decline accordingly, and it would cost all of us less, and they would have performed as individuals, but added up collectively their side of the social contract. So those two statutes do have it in it. I think that what we're engaged in this country is a giant tug of war between how we compute what those obligations are. And I must tell you that as someone, I think I voted for a Democrat once, I don't remember. She might be in the room. I think I voted for one time. So I consider myself sort of a conservative, but the fact of the matter is working in this job for a long time has moved me way to the left on social issues and kept me pretty much right of center on economic issues, and those two can be inconsistent with each other unless there's a social contract, right? Unless there's an understanding where we would use less, and I believe in Freakonomics, right? So if there's a cost to being non-compliant, then you're more likely to be compliant. There are many people who don't agree with that. And the waiver for HIP 2.0 went straight to that point, because what the governor wanted in HIP 2.0 was a consequence for being non-compliant. And that's why he had to get a waiver, because the federal policy is non-compliance has little to do with whether or not you continue to qualify. So that's a big change. All I know is, from 1964 to present, that is the federal entitlement programs, most of which, in my view, have worked pretty well, have arrived at a point where actuarial science has made it the new, as Governor Daniels used to say, the new red menace is not the Soviet Union, it's red ink. And it comes straight out of these programs. So the answer to that's my long-winded answer, and what I meant to say was yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, help me thank Dan Evans for coming to speak with us today. Great. Today's presentation will be broadcast on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 FM on Saturday, March 7th, and is also available for download at WFYI.org. Please join us next month on March 19th as we are joined by Myron Gray, U.S. Operations President with UPS. And don't miss the opportunity to hear from a leader responsible for overseeing a strategic transformation of the company's U.S. small package business, and today streamlining the package delivery and logistics services for the world's largest economy. Information and tickets for the remainder of the season can be found at economicclubofindiana.com. Thank you all for coming, and stay warm.
You've been listening to a speech from Dan Evans, CEO of Indiana University Health, part of the 2014-2015 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. You can find more information at economicclubofindiana.com. Next month at this time, join us for a speech from Myron Gray, President of U.S. Operations for UPS. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Radio in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us.
Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation. With a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.